Now, I'd like to introduce the guest speaker for the month of March. She would be speaking on steps 3, 4, and 5, and that would be Carrie C. from Harrison, New Jersey.
Hi, I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carrie.
Okay, now it's falling out. Sorry. Just messed up the mic there. Okay, now we got it? That's good. Okay. Just take a moment and get silent for a minute and stop thinking about what I'm going to say and just talk. So just give me a sec. Okay. Steps 3, 4, and 5. Jeez, I could fill like days with that stuff. You know, now that Mike's falling in, got it. We left off last week, and I was talking about my experience with step 2, you know, and that step 2, or my real experience, or my real, I don't want to say real experience, but a deepening of that experience happened as I got sober, and as I continued to go through the steps. You know, there's a lot of different factions in AA when it comes to the big book of the steps. I mean, first of all, there are some people who don't believe in the big book. There are some people who don't necessarily work the steps. But within people who work the steps and read the big book and do the steps out of the big book, there's different factions. And there's people who believe that you need to go through the steps once, or people who believe that you can live in 10, 11, and 12. And there are people who believe that you can continually go through the steps, and that's sort of a lifelong process, and you get better at it as you go through it. I'm one of those people. Like, I believe that it's through continually going through the steps that, and it's like a refining process for me. And that as I continually go through the steps, I gain a deeper understanding. Usually, an experience with a step, or as I go through a round of steps, as I'd like to call it, it's a week or even, it could be like months later when the impact of what I learned about that process really comes to me. It's not always when I'm actually doing the work, but it's when I'm applying what I learned in doing the work that I seem to get the biggest breakthroughs. It's when I'm not looking. There's a wonderful teacher, and I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but it's Thich Nhat Hanh, and he talks about being... talks about dishwashing, you know, awakenings, and that it's in washing your dishes, or it's when you're putting away your laundry, or when you're going to the supermarket, that you get this bright insight into a clue as to, you know, where, you know, what's really going on within you. So what I'm gonna talk about is kind of an accumulation of what I've learned about steps 3, 4, and 5. Step 3, you know, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. Well, let's clarify one thing, and I know you've heard this probably a billion times. I don't understand God. I don't endeavor to understand God, because when I try to understand God, I just confuse myself. So, like a lot of people who have had long-term experience with the steps, I prefer to rewrite the steps because that's what I do. I do that a lot. Anybody who's been through the book with me, I rewrite things because it works better, you know. that didn't sound good. No, I rewrite the big book. I do, and I rewrite the steps to made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God that I don't understand, and I'm not even going to try. And so when I talk about that decision. For me, it wasn't a one big decision. I mean, I made a decision to work the steps. And in essence, doing that is turning my will and my life over to care of something that's greater than myself, which is the process of the 12 steps and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so in essence, doing the steps, in a sense, is a turning my will and my life over to the care of God. But in reality, up until I started to do a fourth and a fifth step, and until I looked at who I was, I really didn't know what my will is, and I didn't know what my life was. So I was really turning something I really didn't know much about to something I didn't really know much about. Essentially, I knew I was going to die, and I knew if I didn't do this, I was going to die. I knew that I was unhappy, and this was a way out. It was a crapshoot. I mean, when I really look at it, and when I talk to people, especially newcomers, about the steps and about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I make it really clear. I'm like, listen, okay, drinking equals death, right? Alcoholics commit suicide, we do stupid stuff. You know, we're not the smartest people when drinking. So the chances of living, an alcoholic living while drinking for an extended period of time, after having come into Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not that great. I've been around AA for almost, well, I've been around for 13 years. I've been sober for almost 9 years, and I've seen a lot of people die. So it's been my experience that alcoholics who drink usually die. Usually die bad, too. So drinking equals death. And then there's the steps, which is a possible maybe solution to what's going on. Now, faced with that, with those two possibilities, of course I'm going to look for any way out. That's what I do. I'm an alcoholic. You know, I look for the way out. An easier, softer way, for me, the steps were. You know, so when I was presented with the idea of going through the 12 steps, I mean, I was presented with an option. An option that, although it seemed quite unlikely that writing about my life on a piece of paper, going back and saying I'm sorry 1,000 times for the horrible things I did. I didn't understand what amends was. I thought that meant sorry. We'll get to that. But the point was, is that, you know, but I didn't really understand. It was beyond my conception how doing just a few simple little things could change me so much. You know, I had no idea. I mean, I really didn't. I thought it was like a class exercise. It was kind of like homework, you know. I knew that if I did my homework, I usually passed my exams. I mean, when I didn't do my homework, I failed miserably. You know, I understood that. So when I was presented with the steps, like, I approached it with, I guess, with what I was already familiar with. Like, I looked at it as an assignment. I looked at it as, obviously the book is a textbook, so that was good. I looked at it as something I needed to learn about or I could try. You know, a sort of a trial thing. If the steps didn't work, I could not do them anymore. I didn't really understand that whole thing, if you stop midway through the steps, you drink. Stopping midway through the steps is never good. You're better off not starting them than stopping in the middle because you're in a lot of pain. I learned that. I almost drank. Wrote that 4-step, though. But the point was that when I first approached the steps, when I first approached the 3rd step, I didn't really know that I was making a 3rd step decision. I wasn't really given much of the option. I mean, I was presented with drink or die, and then I was saying, oh, go write this, you know. And for me, writing a 4-step was a better option than dying. You know, so when I really understood that I had made a 3rd step decision, when I had really understood that that I was making or had made a decision or was living on a basis, and this is the way I like to put it, I'm living on a basis that the decision I made to turn my will and my life over to the care of God is a reality. That make sense to you? Makes sense in here. But, I mean, that's what it's about for me. Because I don't believe in fishing. I hear people say it all the time, even big book thumpers, and I want to bang my head on the table. I took my will back. Like, okay, one, how did you take it back? I mean, like, does it have a fishing hook to it and a line? Did you cast it out there and reeled it back in? I mean, I don't really take my will back. I live on a spiritual basis, or I don't. You know, I mean, for me, it's kind of black and white, but it's kind of simple, because when I look at it as in, like, I'm taking my will back, or I'm digging my heels in. I dig my heels in. I'm a human being. I'm an alcoholic. I have character defects. That's all part and parcel of being human being and, you know, and an alcoholic. So, of course, I'm going to dig my heels in. But when I'm motivated by drinking or dying, you know, then I'm going to pick my heels up, and I'm going to do what I have to do. Later on, after going through the steps a handful of times, I'm less motivated by the fear of pain and more and death, and more motivated by what I feel from going through the steps, such as peace, contentment, joy, you know, all that wonderful stuff that the big book promises. But the point is that what was my point? I was going somewhere with that, and I lost it. The point is that when I think about the third step decision, there's a lot of different parts to it. It's not as simple as a lot of people like to make it seem, and it's a process. And a lot of times that process happens as you go through the latter parts of the steps. You know, so I clear that up right away, that I don't believe in fishing, and that I don't take my will back, that that's not how this works. I align my will with God. I don't give my will to God. There's a big difference. The big book never really actually says, give your will away. It says, align my will with God's. You know, that's in the 10th step, but, you know, but the point is that, because it's such a multifaceted process, and it took me such a long time, and I'm still learning I'm still learning what a lot of the big book meant. I mean, I can read it backwards and forwards. I have a photographic memory, and as long as my big book's highlighted, so I'm able to like really pull out pieces there. And I've read it for so long, and I've presented the big book at workshops for so many years, you know, in my home and out, that I knew what the words meant, and I knew the script that was supposed to be said when you talk about the third step, and I knew the script of the second step, the first step, you know. I understood, you know, fear inventory, more, you know, I understood resentment inventory, four columns, five columns, depending on how you set it up, whatever. I understood that, but the deeper implications of those steps, the spiritual learning that goes on as a process of these steps, it changes over the years, and it gets deeper, and it also gets very subtle. You know, the first few times when I realized that I was living on a basis that wasn't my own, when I was living in a place where I wasn't dominated by what I wanted all the time, and I wasn't controlled by fear, and I felt like I had been remotely reborn, or felt like I was a different person. When I felt those things, or when I began to live in that place, I didn't really know what was going on. Like, I really didn't know that it was as a result of doing the steps. I didn't know that I had made that third step decision. I just did what I was supposed to do. I showed up. I did what my sponsor told me to do because I didn't want to die. And as the benefits of the program and the 12 steps, which is like another removal of the obsession of drinking, that was nice. as those things began to fall away, some deeper things came into being. And one of the things, and one of the first parts of the third step, is recognizing that life run on self-will could hardly be a success. You know, I still, after a couple four steps, believe that I could, that things should go my way, and that if only people should behave. And I kind of used the program in a lot of ways to get other people to do what I wanted. Because I played like a good girl, and I followed the rules, and you people should too, because, you know, you work the same program I do. You know, that's the way I thought. I had no... I still believe that other people should adhere to my morality. You know, I had a lot of resentments. Resentment inventories were long back then. But the point was, is that, you know, the first part of the third step is recognizing that life run on my own terms, my self-will could hardly be a success. That I'll be in collision with somebody or something, you know. And it's not until the 11th step that they promise you that you're not, well, the 10th step they promise you not to fight. In the 11th step, they promise you that that you'll have new energy, and that that you won't be, well, I'm going to paraphrase here, that you're not going to be worried about the little things, and that you're not going to, you know, run to extremes in your emotional life. You know, so somewhere between 3 and 11, you know, I learned that that life run out my way could hardly be a success. I saw the evidence of that in my 4th and 5th step. You know, but I really learned about that when I read We Agnostics. You know, I'm going to mess with people here. I don't think the third step, well, the third and the second step are sort of intertwined. And a lot of what's talked about in the third step, or in that whole, like, actor part of the big book, I think it's pages 60 to 63, because I have to reread that at least once a week. I gotta, when I'm fighting something or I think somebody should do what I want, I try to read those pages to remind myself who I am and where I should be. Or allow God to do that, I should say. But, you know, in We Agnostics, it talks about self-sufficiency. You know, it says that that basically we're presented with an experiment, the God experiment. You know, and that that we can either try to experiment and believe that there's a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity and take the actions that are needed to you need to take in order to maintain sobriety and get that sanity. You know, and that's the experiment. You know, you can do that and get what we have, or you cannot do that and do what you always do. But there's another part of that where it talks about self-sufficiency, and that self-sufficiency failed us, and how basically we and I tried to live based on what I thought the world should be, and I fought everything around me, and I never surrendered once to what is. I was never present in the moment. I was always in the past. I was always in the future. And I was always spinning my wheels. And I never really got anywhere. You know, and it talks about that when they talk about the 8 points of an unmanageable life. What they're talking about there in We Agnostics, when it says that, you know, that we're unhappy, that we can't be useful, that we're depressed, that we're full of self-pity. And, of course, I'm paraphrasing again because I've gotten to a place where I stop quoting the book from the podium or I try not to quote directly because I want you to read it. I'm sure you have because you're here, but I want you to read it. I don't want to read your big book for you, but I want to tell you where to look. And it's right at the very end. I think it's page 52 of We Agnostics. And it talks about the results of living life based on self-sufficiency. So I'm presented with the evidence that life based on self-sufficiency can't be a success. So when I get to the third step, and it talks about making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, the first thing I have to recognize is that life run on my own will, it can't be a success, and that I'm not God. Because somewhere along the line, my entire life, I was always trying to control the situation. I was always playing God. I was making demands, either out loud or mentally. I always had expectations, and I was always trying, and I'm going to quote that, I love this, and Stuart Saves the World. Anybody seen that movie? Am I the only one who watches the bad Saturday Night Live movies? Okay, Stuart Saved the World. He said, and I quote, that I'm always trying to carpet the world rather than wearing slippers. And for me, that's exactly what the third step's about. Is that I want to change you to make me comfortable because I don't want to be threatened, I don't want to be afraid, and I don't want to look at me. And the basic idea here is that I am full of selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonesty, and fear. That fear drives my bus most of the time. And that most of the things I did when I was drinking and a lot of the things that I did when I was sober, I did because I was being driven by fear. A lot of things, and this is part of, this is another thing, and I spoke about it last week, about self-loathing, you know. And I said that part of what relieved the intense amount of self-loathing that I had in the first step was when I realized that I was powerless over alcohol and that I had this craving, I had this mental obsession, and I had this spiritual malady, and that it wasn't a moral issue, you know, because I really believed that that I was a piece of crap, and that I was the reason, and I am, but a whole different kind of I. But I personally, Carrie, was the reason why I was so miserable, and why I was ineffectual in my life, and why I just wanted to die. I didn't want to exist. And when I learned about the first step and I realized that, you know, I wasn't drinking because I was defective, or I was defective but in a different way, that I wasn't defective because I was a bad person, I was defective because I had a disease. If you want to use the word defective, which I don't like to use. But when I came to the third step, it says that I was driven by 100 forms of selfishness, self-loathing. Selfishness, self-centeredness, and fear. And that means a lot of the decisions and a lot of the things I did in my life, I didn't do because I made a conscious choice to do it, but because I was driven by selfishness, self-dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I add a couple. So when I learned about that in the big book and it talked to me about that, I realized that a lot of the things I did and a lot of the people that I hurt that I loved, I didn't want to hurt these people. I didn't want to lie to people. You know, I didn't want to be the person I was. And I really kind of believed, even after I learned about, you know, the whole drinking thing not really being my fault, I really believed that underneath that I was still like this horrible person. And that all the decisions I made and all the horrible things I did and all the places that my drinking brought me were because I deserved it. And when I learned that, you know, I had this spiritual illness. And in the big book, it describes it. You know, and it begins describing it, describes it in the doctor's opinion, it touches on it in We Agnostics, but it describes it full throttle, you know, in how it works. When I learned about this spiritual illness, I began to realize that even more of the responsibility that I took for the decisions that I made, as in Carrie's a bad girl, was based in an exaggerated grandiosity. And Joe and Charlie like to call pride in reverse. You know, it's kind of the idea that in How It Works, it talks about us being powerless over selfishness as much as we are over alcohol. And in the fourth step, it talks about us being as powerless over resentment as much as we are over alcohol, and it says so about fear. So unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to look at it, I'm just as powerless without God over selfishness, resentment, and fear and as I am over alcohol. And when I realized that, I think that a lot of my will a lot of my desire to live came back. You know, I think that for me, I lived for a long time with the shadow of who I was when I was drinking. And when I came into the rooms, I still felt like that person was going to come back. And I was waiting for signs of her. Like, every time I did something close to what I used to do, it would freak me out. And I would shake in my boots, and I would feel dirty and disgusted. Until I realized that my own character defects were just as powerless over them as I am over alcohol. And that's why, in the third step, when it talks about life run on our own self-will, it can hardly be a success. It means that if I'm trying to fix me with me, I'm screwed. And that's exactly why the third step starts with that, and then it goes through that whole explanation with the actor. And most of the time I get so caught up in the actor, thinking, yeah, I do that, I manipulate people. Of course I manipulate people, you know, that I don't even realize what it's saying to me. You know, and that's exactly what, you know, what it says to me today. You know, that I can't fix me with me, and I can't think my way through my own character defects. And that's why I have to make a decision and turn my will and my life into a care of a power greater than myself, something which I don't even understand. Because there's no way that I'm going to be able to rationalize my way out of my own pain, out of my own short-sightedness and my own fear. So that's kind of what the third step means to me. A little confusing, a little strange, because I'm kind of a weird girl. But stop shaking your head, Mike. No, I am. But for me, it made sense. You know, I can tell you the logistics. You get down on your knees, you say the third step prayer, you do it with a sponsor, you make a decision to continue with the work, and that's what it's about. You know, but there's a spiritual power beyond the third step that I didn't comprehend until I had gone through the steps a few hundred million times. You know, it took me a long time. I was not one of these people who went through the steps once. It was like, I understand this thing. I've cracked the code. I was like one of those people. I mean, I used the big book against myself half the time. You know? I mean, I was ruthless with that thing. You know? But I was. You know? So When I realized, based on the idea that I'm as powerless over my character defects, or self, let's just call it self, as I am over alcohol, it means I have to take a good look at, you know, what's going on here. I mean, the big book spent, from doctor's opinion, actually forwards, to We Agnostics talking about the first step. I mean, it went through it in detail. I mean, it talked about every possible aspect of insanity, craving, mental obsession, and all kinds of other stuff. It went through great detail of the first step, didn't it? I mean, I think it did. It spent, like, what, 60 pages, something like that? I don't know, I don't count. Mike would know. The point is, it spends quite a few pages talking about the first step. And then, you know, it says, all right, you're broken. You got a problem here. What you gonna do about it? And I put a lot of energy into looking into my first step. I mean, I drank for 9 years. That's not a really long time for some of you people, but it was a long time for me. I did a lot of dumb stuff in that 9 years. So I put a lot of work into my first step. So, realizing once again how powerless I am over myself, I take a look at the fourth step. And it means that I got to go over in just as much detail in the fourth step of the extent and the tapestry. I like to call it the tapestry of my powerlessness. The big book refers to our life being, you know, threaded through with fear, like this corrosive thread. So whenever I think of the fourth step, I think of it like I'm weaving a tapestry. I use a lot of images, you know, and to help me to remember stuff. That really burnt. But when I'm looking at this, I'm looking at the tapestry of my own powerlessness over myself, you know. And when I wrote my four steps, you know, I wrote four different types of four steps. I've done every different kind of form except for the 17 area inventory. I haven't gotten to that yet. I got out of, there's like this 17 area inventory that I've seen, and I kind of got out of the whole compulsive four step thing before I had to write that one. Thank God. I averaged, from the time that I started doing four steps, you know, and I started seriously getting into the work or the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was roughly between 3 and 4 years sober, I averaged about 2 to 4 steps a year. I'm very glad to say I've only done one this year. Yeah. But although I'm still working on it. But the point is that, so let's just say, we could say that I've written quite a few four steps. I can vaguely guess on the number, we're going to say anywhere between 8 and 12. Okay. I'm really compulsive. I told you, I'm a slow learner with this stuff. You take anything that makes me feel good, and I do it all the time. I mean, people would yell at me, and they would just like, why are you writing another four step? Didn't you just fifth step that thing a month ago? I'm like, yeah, but the high is going away. I'm serious. And then they'd be like, well, you know, maybe you need to look at that. I'm like, no, I'm doing the work. So, I have a lot of experience with the four step. and I think that the best way that I can explain the four step without giving the details and the mechanics, which, you know, read the big book, guys. It's in there. I didn't know that then. I thought there were three columns to the four step the first time I wrote one. I didn't get any better. It was all about you, or, you know, my parents mostly, but, you know. And I wondered, like, why I resented them until I wrote another four step, like, 2 years later, you know. But I was trying to do the steps. But the thing about the fourth step, and of course we know that that it's about taking responsibility for who I am and what I do, you know. Because when I talk about responsibility, I talk about two different kinds of responsibility. There's a spiritual responsibility, and there's a guilt, remorse, self-beating, flagellation responsibility. I always had that one because that one got me off the hook of the spiritual responsibility. Because if I'm worthless, then I don't have to actually do anything, do I? And I lived in that worthlessness for a really long time. And it kept me safe, and it kept me from having to take responsibility. I made a lot of, like, really interesting, you know, parallels in my life and decisions, and I hid in a lot of different things, and that was one of the things I hid in. So when I talk about a responsibility in the fourth step, that's what I'm talking about, you know, the spiritual responsibility. And, you know, most of us who have written four steps know what that is. You know, there's, you know, four different kinds of inventories, three, depending on how you do it. There's many different types of formats, and, you know, you can find all kinds of cool stuff, but that's not what I'm here to talk about. You know what I learned about in the fourth step? Was that I made everybody else but God my God. pretty much that's what it was all about. It still is sometimes, I'm telling you. I hate it that it's still in my four-step. They don't like me. No one's going to like me. I'm not good enough. It's funny. I'm in the middle of doing one right now, and I'm, you know, my sponsor and I are going through it nice and slow because our schedules are really, really hectic. And essentially, I wrote three columns, and she's helped me write my fourth because she says I've written enough four steps to be able to rationalize. You know, it's really good. When you write enough four steps, you know exactly what to write in order not to take the responsibility, take responsibility you already did, but not going in deeper. You know, and so she's helping me write my fourth column so I can be a little bit more, go a little deeper, you know, and be a little bit more humble. And it's always the same stuff. It really is. It's really about me making everybody else my God. But one of the things that I hate and one of the things that I kind of love about being sober and having had a spiritual awakening is that I can know what living a spiritual life looks like. And I could know what dependence upon God, I mean true dependence. I'm not talking like 3/4 or 1/3, one of those fractional dependencies on God, which I like to practice. We're talking about absolute reliance upon God. I know what that looks like and I know what it feels like, but I also know that it's difficult to maintain for any extended period of time. Even for the Dalai Lama, so little Miss Carrie Cosgrove has just got to accept her limitations here. You know, I don't levitate. I'd like to, but the point is that, you know, I know what that looks like, and I know what it feels like, but there's something about the humility of being human and accepting my limitations, not reveling in them. There's a big difference between acceptance and reveling in my limitations. I used to revel in my limitations. It was like, I curse because I'm limited. And I give you the finger because I'm limited, you know. And I enjoy being nasty, mean, and surly because I have limitations. No, but what I'm talking about is accepting my limitations, you know, and being humble about it, which is something that it took me a long time to do. I didn't want people to know that I was human. I didn't want you to know that I couldn't actually bring every single principle of this program into my daily life every second of the day. I didn't want that. And so much so that I became so closed down emotionally and I couldn't communicate with other people unless it was like, you know, had to be in a higher spiritual plane, you know. And I hid behind that for a really long time. And if you're in the program long enough, you know exactly what that is. You know, anybody who's been sober for anywhere between 5 and 10 years knows exactly what it is. You know what you're supposed to look like. You know how you're supposed to behave, but inside you really don't feel it. And, I was kind of stuck in that place for a really long time, you know. And part of going through the process now and what I'm learning today is about being more real, you know, and being Carrie and not resisting who I am, you know. I'm sarcastic. God, am I sarcastic. And I'm even a little demented, you know. I'm 26. Of course I'm demented. I hate that. You know, like, I had, like, they put, like, this, like, 2 million-year-old soul. You know, I'm, like, in this 26-year-old body, give me 8 years of sobriety, 2 kids and a husband, and, like, I'm, like, twisted. You know, I'm like this little misresponsible housewife on one end, and I'm like serial killers on the other end. I mean, it just doesn't, it doesn't mesh. You know, I listen to Tool, you know, Indigo Girls, Enya, I do yoga. I mean, like, I'm just a total, I'm mixed up, you know. But that's kind of the point. I don't resist that anymore. I'm not trying to be somebody else. And that was something I was trying to do for a long time because I made everybody else my God. You know, in the third column, it talks about the 7 areas of self that you people affect. You know, they have a first column, which, you know, talks about who the person is, or I like to call the jerk. It used to be the a-hole, but I'm getting better today. So it's the jerk. What that jerk did and how that jerk affected me and my precious little psyche. And, of course, what I did as a result of what they did. Now, I got better. But when I look at the third column, there's like these 7 areas of self. Where, you know, self-esteem, pride, pocketbook, sex relations, personal relations. Trying to count here. Ambition. Oh, how could I miss ambition? It's always ambition. Ambition, is there something else? Security. Ambition and security are always on my list, so I always forget them. But anyway, so then there's these 7 areas of self. And what I learned was that, or my my couple most recent trips through the step was that steps was that I expected you people to provide that for me. My expectation was that you should not upset the apple cart. You shouldn't hurt my self-esteem. Your character defects shouldn't interfere with my ambitions. You know, God forbid you mess with my personal relationships, and certainly don't mess with my home. You know, and I realized that I carried around a lot of resentment and fear because I wanted other people, and that's what I, you know, the big joke about, you know, expecting to carpet the world rather than wearing slippers, was that I made everybody else my God, and I never really went to God asking for those things. Like, I never really went within and said, you know, I want it, you know, I want to live a good life. That's an ambition, isn't it? So why not ask God for the grace to do that? I want to have self-esteem. I'm tired of hating myself, goddammit. You know? So why not ask God to allow me to see myself the way I really am? Because I have carried dysmorphia. You know? Michael Jackson has body dysmorphia. I have carried dysmorphia. You know? I don't see me for who I am. I really don't. I'm either, like, the most brilliant person on the face of the earth, or I'm Hannibal Lecter. Well, he's brilliant, but, you know. So, but the point is that I'm either the most brilliant person on the face of the earth or I'm nothing. There's no in-between for me. There's no being normal. There's no being ordinary. You know, I resisted being ordinary my entire life because I felt ordinary was a defeat. So, you know, when I'm looking at that third column and I realize that I expected people to provide security, to provide love, you know, love has nothing to do. I mean, love lives within each one of us, I believe. You know, and love is a part of God. And if somebody loves me, it's not. You know, there are two things that I learned. One, that if somebody loves me, it's not them loving me, but God. And two, most of the time when people love me, they're loving how they see me, not necessarily who I am. The only thing on the face of this earth that could truly love me for every single particle, every single bit of me, is God. And if I expect human beings to provide that unshakable love, I'm just setting myself up for disaster. You know, and I'm not pessimistic about it either. Like, I don't walk around thinking, I'm unloved. I mean, I do, but I'm not supposed to. It's more along the lines that I know that the people who love me and the people who are in my life love me as much as they're capable of loving me, and sometimes it's a great deal. I mean, I personally feel very loved in my life, more loved than I've ever felt, ever. I mean, it's going to make me cry if I talk about it. I hate crying from the podium, so I'm not going to talk about it. But the point is I feel extraordinarily loved and graced in my life. But I realize that the real love that I'm experiencing isn't the love from a person to me, but God's love within me. You know, and that love that I feel I can carry with me, that's why when I'm at school and I think about my husband or my children, I feel love, because that's God's love. And when I'm in the shop, right, you know, and I think about, oh, I'm going to get this and I'm going to make this beautiful dinner for my family, that's God's love. And that's why the love doesn't get shut off when that person's no longer with me. Now, I never made that connection, you know, because I was one of those people, like, I could not be alone because there would be no love. There would be no mirror reflecting me back to me, because I didn't see myself unless I saw myself the way you saw me. I had no opinion of who I was. I had no self-conception. You know, I was continually, you know, as we grow emotionally and spiritually, and this is what I'm learning in school, you know, we start out with like a mirror image, and that means that a lot of how we develop, how we see the world, is based on how other people react to us. And as we grow up, supposedly, we're supposed to develop our own ideal. But somewhere along the lines, and this is part of my spiritual illness, I didn't do that. So I was continually living on the scraps of what other people would throw me about me. And I never really asked myself how I saw myself. And it changes. I mean, I'm going through another period of time in my life where I'm beginning to see myself in an entirely new way, and I love it. It's scary as hell, because I don't know who I am at times. You know, but that's also a good thing. I mean, it's kind of like not knowing about God. You know, I would rather discover it than dissect it. You know, so essentially, you know, the wisdom that I gleaned from the fourth step was really that. You know, if you want me to distill it, that's pretty much it. And I could say it 1,000 different ways. You know, that I made people my higher power. I use fear to protect myself and to keep you away and to control you. We develop associations as human beings, you know, with things, you know. If I experience something negative, I develop an association for it and I try to avoid it, right? And whenever I see anything that resembles that negative thing, then I avoid it and I develop what's called a fear. And some fears are good, like, you know, bees, and, you know, getting hit by a car, you know, jogging in the park late at night. Those are, you know, some pretty decent fears to have. I mean, they kind of, they're survival instinct. And there's other fears or associations that I created that that really robbed me and served no purpose. I mean, they might have when I developed them, but then they lost their usefulness just like alcohol did. You know, and I really believe the program is cyclical. You know, we talk about the steps and the kind of, you know, think graduations, and for me it's not like that. It's a cycle. And each, if you look at the steps, you look at the traditions, and you look at the concepts, which I don't understand, I'm trying to, they're confusing, but if you look at those things, they often repeat themselves. The same things that they talk about in the 12 steps, you'll find reflected in another way or in another facet in the traditions. And so, and I'm going somewhere with this, when I looked at fear, you know, I realized that fear played the same role in my life that alcohol did. And that I developed the same association with my fears that I did with alcohol, that they were a solution. That, you know, my fear of not being liked, right? Well, if I was a people pleaser and I did what everybody expected me to do and I was not myself, but I made you happy, then it kept you from running for a little while, didn't it? So in essence, fear became a tool for me. But what happened, and the same thing that happened with alcohol, is that that tool no longer worked, but I had the insanity that believed it did. You know, and so when I did a fourth step and I realized how insane it was that I made those associations and kept them, that I didn't mature or grow, I didn't evaluate my experience and ask myself, is this working for me? I mean, that's part of what I did, you know, in the fear inventory. And again, it's just another reflection of how I made people God and how I could not or did not rely upon God to provide what I needed. It's funny because when it says, like, what I should do instead, when it comes to fear, it's always first and foremost, rely on God. Trust God. Stop trying to push your will and blah, blah, blah. But it's pretty much always that. And the last thing I'm going to talk about in about the four step or, you know, was that when the big book talks about this, it says that it equates fear with stealing. And a lot of times people, I didn't understand it. And the first time it was explained to me, it was explained that, well, it was a conscious decision. I made a conscious decision of fear the first time I created that fear, and therefore fear is a conscious decision, and so is stealing. Well, not if you're a kleptomaniac, but that's a whole other story. But the point is that I don't think that that's what Bill meant. I think that when Bill said that fear should be classed with stealing, it's because it robs. My fear robbed me, my family, and the people I loved of security. You know, because I was never Carrie. I was always somebody else. I never told you who I was or what I felt. I remember the first time my husband said to me, he's like, what do you really think? And I was just like, I don't know. I hadn't thought about what I thought about anything. Now I have plenty of opinions, and trust me, you don't want to hear them. But the point is that I never really thought about what I believed my entire life. I developed opinions that fit an ideal. Like, you know, for a while I thought I was Jim Morrison. You know, I wanted to be Janis. You know, I was a punk rocker. I mean, I was always an ideal. So then I created philosophy, you know. So when I talk about fear and being classed with stealing, I mean that it robs other people because they never really know who I am and I never really know who they are. That I'm never truly honest and I never truly experience love because I'm so busy trying to control that I never actually submit to being loved. and therefore it robs the security of all the people around me. I don't know how many people loved me for who I said I was, and when they found out that I wasn't that person, how devastating it must have been. You know, and when I've gone to make an amends to them, and they're amazed that I'm actually that person I pretended to be for so many years. It's kind of amazing, you know, that I tried to be somebody for so many years, tried to be so many different people at so many different times, and then when I stopped trying to pretend and I actually looked at who I was, you know, I became a lot of the things that I wanted to be. When I took my inventories and I brought them to other people, and I did my fifth step, you know, the first thing I think I can remember about the fifth step was the first time I actually let anybody in on any kind of level. And it was actually when I did that crappy three-column inventory that was all about everybody else, because it was the first time I actually, like, even admitted how I felt to anybody, you know. The fifth step for me has been a lot about humility, in a sense, but it's also been about, I never was vulnerable. I always had a wall up, I had a facade, and I kept people out. And when I've done a ton of fifth steps. I've done fifth steps with men. You know, that whole men with men with women. It was suggested to me to do that because I hated men. I thought they should all, like, be, like, herded off into, like, Idaho and just use them to propagate the species and they can all kill each other. I really had a lot of issues with men, and it was suggested to me to find an older, you know, kind of sexless guy to do an inventory with. Somebody who was, you know, who was in a spiritual path and whatever, you know. Somebody that was going to manipulate the fifth step in order to try to get in his pants. It's happened. Not with me, though. But the point was is that it was suggested to me to do inventory or do a fifth step with a man and finally, like, be vulnerable with somebody with my clothes on. You know, it's funny because Marianne Williamson talks about being so closed off and never truly being naked, even when you're naked. You know, and that was something that I had experienced in my life, that I never really was vulnerable. I never really let anybody in. And I only let you in when it was on my terms, when I had some kind of control. You know, and being a woman, let's face it, I'm not that strong, but we have some control. You know, we don't like it. I know I don't like it. I don't like it, but the fact is that I knew that most of my friends were men for a reason. I never really got close to women because they were competition and because I could not manipulate them the way that I can manipulate men. Then, not now. when I did this, and I'm talking about this fifth step because it changed me in a very profound way. I had taken the same four step to my sponsor, and it was a really healing thing. I can remember just crying with her and, you know, telling her about all these things, all these warts that I had. But she kind of knew them anyway because she had listened to me bitch for the 6 months that it took me to write it. But taking this to a guy and sitting in a park, you know, in the drizzling rain, and when I took the four step, I still have it. It's all, like, wrinkled and wadded up, and, like, you know, like the you know, ink is runned, and it had coffee on it. But taking this to somebody and being vulnerable on that level with no expectation, but only truly to get better, was a really beautiful thing. And I had taken all those warts that I had taken to my sponsor, and I brought it to this person. And I think that's what I learned about myself in the process, was that I had used attraction. I had used the fact that I was a woman to keep women out and to keep men, manipulate them to justify whatever it is that I wanted to justify and to feel safe. You know, and through doing that inventory and recognizing that about myself, and I didn't recognize it in what I wrote, I recognized it when I walked away. And I realized I had been really honest with this person. And it wasn't for anything other than to get better. And then I realized how many times I had not really told people who I was or hadn't really been honest about how I felt because, or, you know, got somebody to co-sign it because, because I would go to a guy. You know, I've been brought through the steps, and then this will make sense. I'd been brought through the steps the first couple times by men. I did fist steps with women, but I had been stepped by men. And so now I had a female sponsor. And I had a female sponsor who brought me through the steps. But it was the first time I really became honest about who I was. And when I went and I brought this inventory, it was really profound. I can remember, like, 3 days later, being in the DMV and not getting annoyed. And I remember, like, thinking, like, so this is a spiritual awakening. Oh, my God. You know, because I didn't even know that I was at peace. Because it wasn't anything that I had participated in. It was just something that happened to me. Because of the steps that God and I took together. You know, and when I did that fifth step in that park, you know, it wasn't him that I was talking to. It was God. You know, I'd always look to women to make me feel safe. I always looked to women to justify. I mean, I could talk about all the horrible things that men did to me. And I would get the cosign on a lot of it because I had a pretty rough life. You know, not anymore because I picked the right sponsors, by the way. And I talked to the right people. But up until that point, I can get the cosign on a lot of it. You know, and even from men because they felt bad for me because I was this little girl who had been hurt in her life. You know, and to talk about the resentments and the fears and who I was without being the victim was a really amazing thing for me. You know, it wasn't that role that I played anymore. You know, because I shared intimate details about my life from the podium, from the table. I mean, I would come into AA and I was like one of those people who would just throw up on the table. You know, and I would just like, and I know people would think like, don't you have a sponsor? It's like, yeah, I didn't tell her any of this stuff. I'd come here. And that's kind of the point, you know, that I always went to people with my pain with a role. I was the victim or the survivor or feel bad for me, co-sign my stuff, and I would present it in such a way that I would get that reaction. And it was through doing that fifth step with my sponsor and then taking it to this guy that that I didn't go with the victim role in mind. I didn't go there for that. I didn't get that. And even if I did, he wouldn't have given it to me because he was so mean. I'm kidding. He's probably one of the mildest guys you'll ever meet. In fact, he doesn't even wear shoes. But, you know, the point is that it wasn't in me at that time. And I think that all of the things that I had learned up until that point in doing inventory, all the experiences with inventory up until where I was then, it was the first time I took off that hat. I'd wore the victim hat my entire life. And then I wore the survivor hat because, you know, I made it through all those things and, you know, I'm better now and, you know, I felt superior to people and I wanted some sense of control, you know. And in doing the fifth step, I learned a lot about control, you know. I learned a lot about, you know, the whole point of the fifth step is like, again, if I could fix myself, jeez. You know, like, you know, when I started talking about, you know, how I can't fix myself, that I'm just as powerless over my character defects as I am over my drinking. And I can write inventory until the cows come home, but unless I talk about it with another human being, you know, the Oxford Group has a saying that sunlight shines through two windows more than one. More sunlight shines through two windows than one. You know, and yes, you know, I have an awakened spirit. I'd like to think so. I'm kidding. No, I have an awakened spirit, and I can do inventory, and I've done enough inventory. I've heard enough fifth steps to be able to, you know, to pretty much dissect myself in a lot of ways. But it's through sitting with another human being and sharing that and getting their feedback, their insight, and their love. You know, I think that's more than anything else what helps me be honest with myself is the security of God's love working through another human being when I'm sitting with them doing a fifth step. Because, again, you know, when I'm sitting alone in my room writing that inventory, I'm feeling all those things that I felt. You know, I pray when I go into inventory and I ask God to help me. And when I put the inventory down, I ask God to help me leave it down and not to bring those emotions, those things back into my daily life. But when I'm sitting with a fifth step and the love of God is shining through that person, I can really look at myself unflinchingly and usually without judgment. You know, and it gives me the freedom to do that. You know, and that's what I get out of fifth step now. I mean, then it got, helped clarify some of the lies I was telling myself. I tell women now, and it sounds really bad, but I'm like, don't even write your fourth column the first couple times you write a fourth step because you're just lying to me and wasting space. We'll just write it together. Because half the time it's the third column of lying even more. It affected them, so they did this. And I'm like, no, we don't care. This isn't cause and effect. You know, what decisions did you make based on self? You know, that's kind of what it's about. You know, so for me today, I mean, I guess that sounds a little Nazi-ish, but I suggest that newcomers the first few times or the first time through the fourth step that don't write their fourth column, that they have their sponsors help them. You know, it benefits me and it saves a lot of time, saves some trees. And in fact, I do it right now. I submitted to it with my sponsor. She's helping me write my fourth column. You know, I had to get humble enough to say, all right, I don't know anything about my resentments. You tell me where I'm being selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightened. Because I know all the ways I used to be. And I know some of them are still here, but you tell me more. Something else I could say about the fifth step is I think the greatest thing about a fifth step is hearing one. There were a couple times, and like I said, I explained that one time. Actually, most of the times when I felt like, oh my God, I have an awakened spirit, what happened? And the first real time that I felt it was after that fifth step. Up until that point, I was doing the mechanics, and I knew I had a relationship with God, but I didn't really know what an awakened spirit felt like. And I had done that fifth step, those two fifth steps back to back, one weekend and then another weekend, and all of a sudden I'm at the DMV and no one's annoying me, and I couldn't believe it because I had an undercurrent of annoyance with everything and everybody my entire damn life. You know, I'm sarcastic, I'm Irish, you know, annoyance is just I breathe, you know. That's just part of who I am. That was the first time I felt that. And the second time I felt that was listening to a fifth step. It wasn't the first time I listened to a fifth step. But I was sitting there and I'm listening to this person. And I'm realizing I'm hearing a lot of the same stuff that I go through or that I do. And I didn't feel alone. And I didn't feel useless. And I felt probably... such a definite sense of God being within me. Because here is this person offering themselves to me to allow God to come through me in order to help them. And I thought to myself, I'm like, is she retarded? Is she stupid? What is she doing? Like, what's wrong with her? Why is she sitting here? She's talking to the wrong person. And then I realized that, oh my God, this woman trusts me. I'm worthy of trust today. You know, I didn't trust God my entire life, and I began to trust God, and I became trustworthy, because fear did not control me the way it used to. And so when this woman was sitting and she was sharing the most poignant and beautiful stuff about her life, which was stuff that we all go through, but it was hers, and she shared it with me, I mean, I truly felt for that moment, and I still do every time I sit down and do a fifth step. Like God really does live within me. And that God really can work through me. And that I could be of service to people in life. Not just in Alcoholics Anonymous. And not just, you know, in the most simple ways, but also in the most delicate ways. You know, because when people come and when I go to do a fifth step, I'm bringing my broken, what I perceive to be my broken self. You know, and I'm asking that person reserve judgment and I'm asking for them to sit with me and God and figure out what the heck's going on here. You know, and when someone comes to me and allows me to participate in that, I feel like I'm a part of
a part of a greater whole. And one, I feel like I'm giving back to the world. I took so much from the world. I took so much from AA. I spent years in here just lying and manipulating and using and justifying. And I mean, even when I was sober, I would only share about myself only to get you to tell me I was okay. I mean, geez, that's not your job. Your job is to tell me I'm not okay, and this is what you should do, kid. But the point is I spent so much time robbing from other people in the world. That, you know, sitting down with another human being and hearing their fifth step, or helping them with their fourth step, or taking a third step with them, you know, taking that formal third step, it allows me to put back in the world some of that spiritual energy I robbed, to heal. You know, and I feel like I'm making an amends. I feel like I'm making an amends for the things and the harm that I caused. I mean, it's one thing to go make an amends to the people that I harmed. It's another thing to put that back out and heal and help heal other people. The way that, you know, I was so broken and so hurt and so damaged when I came in, you know, and to help another person to get well. I mean, it's an amazing thing. And the thing that strikes me the most about the fifth step, and I guess I'll end with this, and it's usually at my kitchen table. And I always think about it when Bill talks about it. He talks about it a couple times in the book when he talks about, you know, at our kitchen tables, you know, in very early recovery. And let's face it, you know, you can learn about the steps in the rooms. You can go to a meeting and you can learn about the fourth step. You can write that alone. But when you're sitting down and doing a fifth step with another human being, you're doing exactly what those people did in 1934, 1935, 1936, 1937. In the very early Alcoholics Anonymous, that's exactly what those people did. And so when I'm sitting there and I'm saying that third step prayer before we speak, and when I sit with my sponsor and she does that for me, I feel like I'm a pioneer of Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel like I brought AA and I took it out of the meeting and I put it in my home. That it's in my life. And it's a part of who I am. And I'll do fifth steps, and my kids are running through. It's so funny because people, you know what? If you're at a place where you're not okay with your secrets, man, don't do a fifth step with me in my house. You know. But the point is that, you know, we'll go someplace special until I break you of that. Seriously, I mean, it's funny because I could do a fifth step. There's very few things that I don't share from the podium. There's very few things that I can't say in a meeting because I'm okay with me. Because I do fifth steps and I live this program, and there's very few things that I'm ashamed of anymore. So I can pretty much do a fifth step in the middle of a crowded diner with my kids running around. I do my own fifth step with my kids running around. You know, not in the room, trust me, but I mean, they'll come through, beg me for juice, and I'll stop talking. But that's enough for me. I just really want to thank you for allowing me to be here, and thank you for listening.